You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Milwaukee is hosting the National At-Home Dads Convention tomorrow and Friday. We'll talk to one of the organizers and a presenter at the event about the issues facing fathers who stay at home and take the lead on childcare. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about living between two worlds.
How do you define home if you've grown up in multiple places? It's a question Paul Lohr of Kimberly has grappled with for years. So he went to visit his first home for clarity. He shares his story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
What is it like to call one of the most secret places on earth home? In the 1970s, I lived there, and then I left. For much of the 1960s and 1970s, this place I called home was closed to the outside world. For the past 60 years or so, it was one of the most dangerous places in the world to visit. After 45 years away, I finally had the opportunity to return home. It's a home that's far, far away from Kimberly, Wisconsin, where my family now lives. It's a home somewhere in Central Laos. From an early age, the thought of one day returning home intrigued me, fascinated me, and motivated me. Back in November 2022, I was finally home. I made it to Vientiane, Laos. My main goal was to retrace the path that many Hmong, including my family, took in the 1970s to seek refuge in Thailand. From Vientiane, my wife, Maya, and I, along with our driver and his wife, headed to Long Son. Along the journey, we drove by a section of the Mekong River, where many Hmong, including my family, crossed to seek refuge in Thailand. This is where I lost my mother and one of my two sisters. Like many Hmong making this journey, my mother and sister drowned. We could not salvage their bodies to give them proper burials. I was about 5 or 6 years old. As we were departing the area, Maya whispered to me, "Any tears inside of you?" I, of course, had many unexplained emotions, but replied, "No, they dried up a long time ago." Our next stop was Mun Aw, the last village my family lived in before leaving for Thailand. Standing on the outskirts of Mun Aw, I saw the entire village. I can still visualize our hut. I felt so relieved to finally see a place that I thought I would never see again. The next day, we visited several remaining historical landmarks from the Secret War in Laos, which is a secret military operation by the United States to counter communism in Laos and Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s. First, we stopped by Phu Biat, which is the tallest mountain in Laos. This is where my father was assassinated. This site was the last stronghold for the Hmong, who supported the United States and stayed behind after the United States had already left Southeast Asia in 1975. Visiting here makes the few wonderful memories I still have of my father even more meaningful. After a week visiting my Laos home, I returned to my Wisconsin home, enlightened, enriched, and fulfilled. I finally felt at peace. I finally come to embrace that my far, far away home in Laos is no longer my home. It's simply now a part of my past. Home is now Kimberly, Wisconsin.
Paul Lohr is the Associate Dean of the School of Education at UW-La Crosse. His story is part of the Home Is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of 6 media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press-Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the number of fathers who are stay-at-home parents has nearly doubled over the last 30 years, as men now represent about 1 in 5 stay-at-home parents in the U.S. Spending more time in the house with the kids can be rewarding. It can also be isolating for many dads who can feel stigmatized and may not be able to connect as easily with other men who are in the workforce. The nonprofit National At-Home Dad Network is working to reduce those challenges and advocate for fathers. They're bringing their efforts to Milwaukee with an annual convention, Home Dad Con, tomorrow and Friday. We're finding out more about what dads are dealing with as stay-at-home parents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? If you're a dad, if you or someone you know exited the workforce to be a stay-at-home parent, what led to that? Has it brought you closer to your family? Has it created other challenges? Share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jonathan Heisey-Grove is the president of the National At-Home Dad Network, a stay-at-home father of two. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on today.
And Noel Chesley is associate professor in the sociology department at UW-Milwaukee, who will be one of the presenters at this week's At-Home Dad Convention. Noel, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me again.
Jonathan, let's start with you. First, can you give us a taste of what stay-at-home dads would get out of going to Home Dad Con?
Well, really what we get out of it is a chance to reaffirm, recharge, and reconnect with stay-at-home dads and what it means to be a stay-at-home dad. We really look to provide the tools to be better fathers, as well as just give guys a chance to take a break. I mean, being a stay-at-home parent is a big job, and this gives us a chance to not only learn about what others have done and what others can do, but also gives us a chance to just get a little bit of a break and enjoy ourselves, but always coming back to how are we going to become better by the end to bring that home to the family.
And Jonathan, can you give us a little sense of your stay-at-home dad experience yourself?
Yeah, I am a 11-year stay-at-home dad. I became a stay-at-home dad not by choice, but by circumstance. Mm-hmm. And I have two kids. They are a teenager and a soon-to-be teenager. They are my foundation, but I came into this role unprepared for what it meant to be an at-home parent. And so by finding the National At-Home Dad Network and finding the convention, I found guys who were going through the same things I was going through. And it provided me the opportunity to learn and grow as a parent and learn what it meant to be a better father, a better husband, a better partner in the caring of our kids.
Noel, we've talked about your research in the past on how families handle stay-at-home parenting. Stay-at-home dads are not the majority, as I mentioned at the outset, but why do you think we've seen a steady increase in the number of dads being the primary caregivers at home?
Well, I mean, we've definitely seen, I think, more of a spotlight on men at home, but I would just set the records straight and say that there's still a pretty small number mm-hmm. of dads. And that's one of the reasons why I think an organization like this is so important, where a lot of moms who are at home might have more informal opportunities to connect with each other because there's just more of them. I think for men in that role, they really have to build a structure to be able to find other men that are dealing with, as Jonathan said, some of the challenges of being an at-home parent, which I don't think are the same for men as they are for women who take on that role.
And what do you see, Noel, as some of the biggest differences for that stay-at-home dad as opposed to a stay-at-home mom?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of them. One of the things I would say at the outset that can be a problem that's a larger structural problem is the gender wage gap. So it's a hard decision for families to make anyway, to have one person stay home and not be out in the labor force, especially in like high inflation times like we have now. But it's even harder when on average women earn less. So it just gives families less flexibility to even act on that impulse if they want to do it. But Jonathan mentioned some of the others. There's stigma involved. And there might even be a lack of kind of more informal preparation that is more linked to kind of the gender roles that we attribute to men and mm-hmm. women in the family.
And Jonathan, yeah, jump in on that. The stigma and the gender roles. I heard you nodding along there.
Yeah, I mean, to Noel's point, the parenting realm is predicated on moms being the primary caregivers. So for dads, the challenge is overcoming those socio-prescribed ideas of who is a caregiver, and working to show that men are as capable as women of the care of their children. Just there's so many structures that have been developed over the decades that have been predicated on women being caregivers that it's hard for dads to get inroads in those spaces and for men to feel comfortable in.
We're talking to National At-Home Dad Network President Jonathan Heisey-Grove and UW-Milwaukee Sociology Professor Noel Chesley about the challenges facing stay-at-home dads and why more men are leaving the workforce, staying at home, though still, as Noel mentioned, a minority for sure. The At-Home Dad Convention is coming up tomorrow in Milwaukee. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Does your family have a stay-at-home parent? How did you decide which parent that was going to be? If you are or have been a stay-at-home dad, as Jonathan is, as I was for a couple years, love to hear your experience as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about stay-at-home dads and the National At-Home Dads Convention happening tomorrow and Friday in Milwaukee. Our guests today are National At-Home Dad Network President Jonathan Heisey-Grove, who's organizing that convention, and UW-Milwaukee Sociology Professor Noel Chesley, who is speaking at the event. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is your story or any of the men in your life exited the workforce, completely or in part, to be stay-at-home dads. What questions do you have about what happens at the convention, about some of the stigma that they're trying to break? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hey, Marcus.
Hey, Rob. So my oldest son is now 21, his way to being 21. My oldest daughter is 16. When they were, I think she was about 2.5 and he was like, whatever, 6 or whatever around there. I took approximately 1.5 years off, just to spend some extra time with them. And at the time, my ego took quite a bit of a hit because people would, you know, my friends would joke with me, "Hey, how's it going, Mr. Mom? Easy day doing dishes and hanging out at the house." And it was like, once I got past all that, to anybody who's thinking about doing this, I say that they should definitely go do it, because I am so glad I did. And if I could go back, I would do more, because it goes by so quick and you'll miss it if you blink. So to anyone thinking about it, I strongly recommend it. You know, at least give it a try.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. Jonathan, I'm guessing you've heard a lot of both sides of Marcus's story, the judgment there and the joy.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that we hear often is the Mr. Mom moniker. And, you know, I love Michael Keaton and I love that movie, but it's just so out of date. We have the Dads Don't Babysit moniker now. And it really speaks to the fact that dads are just as capable as women at taking care of their kids. And so the network and the convention work to break those stigmas. And your caller is just one representation of many representations of men who go through the similar experiences of being that guy who is, you know, taking the time and dedication to care for their kids and be there for their kids. And like he said, it's a moment that you can't reclaim if you miss it. And we're starting to see through some of the studies that we are familiar with, particularly Equimundo, another group that's out there that's looking at fatherhood, that men are actively wanting to be a part of those early and formative years of their kids' development. So we're starting to see that trend change, but there's still that stigma sitting out there.
Marcus, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Noel, I've talked to you in the past about your research on, you know, when the man is at home as the primary caregiver for the most part, and the woman is working and being the primary, you know, money earner in the family. How have you seen that change family dynamics? Is that changing over the years?
Yeah, well, certainly I can't speak so much to the over the years part, but the family dynamic part I can definitely say a little bit more about. First of all, I think a lot of becoming a really fantastic caregiver, a lot of research shows that it really is about exposure. And I think the experience that Marcus was talking about kind of speaks to that, that anyone, whether they're a man or a woman who spends a lot of time with young children or older children for that matter, gets better at it over time. That it's sort of a skill set you can develop. And a lot of people take satisfaction in doing that work. It's not just moms that can gain satisfaction from that. Dads can too. So I think that's one of the really great ways it can change family dynamics is that in my own work, one of the things that I found was that parents felt a lot more equal in their level of parenting skill over time, because there's a lot of factors pushing moms, even when they're employed outside of the home, towards parenting. They still stay pretty involved, but dads get the chance to get a lot more hands-on than they might otherwise.
Jonathan, I wanted to talk about, you know, how we bring up kids, because, as a guy, when we first had kids, all the diaper stuff was new to me. My wife had done, you know, babysitting starting when she was, you know, like seven. Then when I was working at home a little bit and in charge of the kids, I was learning on the job in a lot of ways. Should we start thinking about bringing up boys and girls with some familiarity with this stuff?
Absolutely. There are a lot of dads in this space that are actually doing that, that's showing, like, being an example instead of an exception is something that I believe in a lot. And I try to instill that in my kids. But, showing that you are as capable as mom at dealing with, a blowout diaper or feeding problems is just as important as mom. And so dads have the capability of handling those situations. And by being that example, it provides your kids the opportunity to say that, you know, when I have kids, I can do it as well.
Talking to Jonathan Heisey-Grove, president of the National At-Home Dad Network, and Noel Chesley with the Sociology Department at UW-Milwaukee, talking about stay-at-home dads. Big convention kicking off tomorrow in Milwaukee. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls. Dan is with us in New Berlin. Dan, hi.
Hi. Yeah, when I heard the term Mr. Mom, it brought back memories of back in the mid-80s. I used to work for Miller Brewing Company, Miller Coors now, and we went on strike. And for 3 months, and luckily it was June, July, or maybe May, June, July, something like that. Anyways, I had one child that was in kindergarten and the other one was just born. My wife, fortunately, was able to take a job for those 3 months. So I pretty much, hey, that was back before disposable diapers, I'm washing them out by hand and hanging them on the line. And, it was like, well, we realized, don't take the car unless it's absolutely necessary. Well, and she had her own car. My wife did to drive to work. But, it just, the Mr. Mom thing really rung a bell, because when I came back to work, that was, unfortunately, right when this happened, I was a reporter came to my house and interviewed me and took, you know, pictures of me taking the kids to school. And it was just, yeah, I really got to, you know, realized, you know, that my wife didn't have it as gravy as I thought she did.
Dan, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Yeah. It's just our last couple of minutes. I want to ask each of you, has that Mr. Mom perception changed over the years? Noelle, your thoughts in just a minute, and then I'll throw it to Jonathan.
Well, I know when I did my interviews with some at-home dads, they were still, and this was about 10 years ago, they were still hearing things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jonathan can probably speak to the most recent experience, but a lot of these cultural touchstones do have a way of hanging on.
And she's absolutely right. They do hang on. And what we as an organization try to do is try to dispel those myths. And again, going back to the being the example, being present at parenting meetings, being present at school, being present in your community as a parent that is caring for kids can do a lot to dispel the myth of being a babysitter, at being a Mr. Mom, shall we say. And, you know, guys who are experiencing, like your last caller, for that brief moment, realizing that it's not as easy as it seems. I think if you know, your listeners and those in the country that aren't familiar with parenting or want to do it, they need to get into it. They need to embrace it and realize that parenting has a lot of rewards that you miss if you ignore it and decide not to do it.
Thanks to both of our guests, Jonathan Heisey-Grove, president of the National At-Home Dad Network, and Noelle Chesley, associate professor and sociology department chair at UW-Milwaukee, with us today to talk about the National At-Home Dads Convention in Milwaukee this week and challenges facing fathers who are mainly the caregivers for their kids. Tomorrow on Central Time, the latest on Brewers Stadium funding, that and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a UW business professor shares a study looking at same-sex couples and how they've struggled in some cases to navigate a wedding industry that's been slow to change traditional bride-groom marketing. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It's not easy to plan a wedding under any circumstance. So many ideas and traditions and judgments to consider and weigh, what friends and family might think about how we do this or that. But for same-sex or other non-binary couples, weddings can be even more complex and challenging to navigate. In part, that's because many parts of the wedding industry developed over the years to serve a bride and a groom and didn't quickly catch up after same-sex marriage became legal around the country. Our next guest examined what happens to people in that position where they're trying to wade through a marketplace that wasn't set up to serve them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how the wedding industry does or doesn't serve same-sex couples? Are you part of a same-sex couple that's either planning a wedding or had one since same-sex marriage became legal around the country? What was your experience like working with different parts of the industry to put together whatever type or mix of ceremony, celebration, or event you had? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Amber Epp is an associate professor of marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. She's co-author of a study on this topic that was recently featured in the Journal of Consumer Research. Amber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you and your colleague did a lot of this research as same-sex marriage became legal, first in particular states around the country, then nationwide. Can you talk about the sort of interviews and shopalogs you had with the people you talked to?
Sure. So the lead author on the study, Sunaina Valigaletti Schultz, was working on her dissertation project right during the legalization of marriage between same-sex couples. And so we were really interested in how couples were navigating the change, as well as how the wedding industry was responding. So she spent about 2 years in the field between 2013 and 2015 interviewing 30 same-sex couples who are planning their weddings, as well as attending wedding expos and wedding industry conferences to see how the wedding industry itself was actually addressing the topic of legalization at the time.
What were some of the main things they encountered when they went to stores or went to the wedding expo?
I think one of the main things they encountered was just the being constantly confronted by the binary in the wedding script. So the wedding script itself is grounded in a bride-groom assumption, and that assumption carries out through most aspects of the wedding industry itself. And so going to wedding expos and bridal expos that you might see even here around Madison, same-sex couples were confronted with all sorts of, you know, forms that were asking for bride and groom, or imagery that was just not very inclusive. A lack of awareness, I would say, at the time among vendors about how to do LGBT-friendly weddings or think more expansively about gender inclusivity than just kind of being locked into the assumptions of a bride and groom.
Now, you're coming at this as a marketing professor. I think a lot of sociologists have looked at these kind of, you know, changes and things like that. What, as a marketing professor, do you see in this about how a business, a big industry, actually the wedding industry, serves or maybe doesn't quite serve part of their audience?
Yes, I'd say marketing is probably a strange home for this kind of study, because you're right, mostly sociologists look at this. And of course, we drew really heavily on the work of sociologists, as well as historians looking at the wedding industry, as well as marriage and the ideals that are kind of embedded in the wedding script itself that makes it a binary. I think from a business perspective, the reason that it makes sense in the business school is for companies to be a lot more aware of the assumptions that are built into their scripts. So we were looking at it from the perspective of consumers in the wedding market, the couples themselves, and what is their experience when they're in the marketplace shopping and they find an absence of diversity in the kinds of attire that are available, or they confront assumptions of the bride always being the one planning when really it's the groom that's doing all of the work in some of these scenarios, and what happens when the marketplace doesn't recognize that. And so I think for us, we were quite interested in the emotional experience of consumers as they were confronted with this binary over and over, and how that gave them a sense or a lack even of legitimacy, of not being in sync with the script, especially since the script was kind of written without them.
Talking to Amber Epp from the Wisconsin School of Business, co-author of a study on same-sex marriage and how the wedding industry, as same-sex marriage became legal, dealt with or didn't deal with that change, and the personal experiences of same-sex couples who encountered that. You could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nick is with us in Fort Atkinson. Nick, hi.
Hi, Rob. Good to hear from you guys today on this subject. It's very important.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Nick? You've got an experience?
Yeah, so I live just in Jefferson County, just to the east of Dane, and we got married about 4 years ago. We had to make an appointment. We just did a courthouse wedding, but I think it's kind of a shame that, knowing ahead of time that we were a same-sex couple, the only forms they had on hand were for men and women, and so they literally looked at us and said, which of you wants to be the bride? And so far, it hasn't caused any kind of legal issues or anything like that, but we were hesitant, you know, and not given any warning other than the day of when we show up for our ceremony, that's how it was going to be. So it's kind of a shame that even at the state level, that's not just required to be on hand for same-sex couples.
And you couldn't, they wouldn't let you like cross out bride and write in groom too or something like that?
We weren't sure if that was going
to
make anything null or void, or what kind of legal implications that would be. So we just went ahead, and I guess I'm the bride.
All right, Nick, thank you. Sorry about that, but thank you so much for sharing that experience. Amber, this is something that the couples involved in your study ran into in some cases, and this is one of the strategies you found, saying up front, I can't remember which kind of wedding store it was, yeah, neither of us is the bride, please don't call us the bride. Can you talk about that a little?
This was such a common experience in our data. So not just forms, but as you were saying, just the assumptions of who's going to be the bride. You know, all of the wedding script aspects, who's going to propose, whether both people should have an engagement ring, who's going to walk down the aisle, all of those things come with this assumption, this built-in assumption of a gender binary. And so even though, you know, every couple that's planning a wedding has to make choices about how to personalize the wedding, the couples in our study really had to confront that idea of taking on a role that was meant for a different gender and being constantly reminded that this is a binary. So I think that Nick's experience is unfortunate. It's exactly what we found in the study, that the industry itself was really slow to respond in terms of infrastructure and updating of forms, but also just in terms of questioning and re-examining their own assumptions about who might be participating in this space.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Amber, you and your co-author give different ways that same-sex couples dealt with some of these things they were encountering, and you just used one of the words, actually, confront. In some cases, same-sex couples went in and said, yeah, you're not set up for us. Here's what we're going to need from you. Can you talk about how that went?
So much of that, yes. So the couples in our study had lots of different strategies for navigating and both working with the wedding industry as well as kind of working against the wedding industry to try and get them to update the script to be more gender inclusive. So one of the strategies they used was just direct confrontation to say to the service provider or the courthouse, you know, you need to update your forms, you need to think more expansively about this. Other strategies involved more collaboration. So working with wedding photographers, for instance, to say, okay, here's what our vision is for the wedding, but we know that in positions in photographs, there's some semblance or signals of what gender roles, who's standing, who's sitting, where are people positioned? And we're really conscious about what that means for the way that we're positioned. So they did collaborate with Marketplace service providers to say, how could we do this in a way that feels really authentic for us and also recognizes our own gender expression and gender roles. And then other examples are things like masking. So one of the things that we've found in prior literature really is that if you don't have to disclose something and it's easy for you to participate. So really, feminine brides that were just shopping for a traditional wedding dress could kind of move through the space without having to constantly disclose that they were marrying another bride. And so we saw that in the study too. And for us, that was a really interesting point because many of the participants really talked about the emotional toll that that took on them as they were planning the wedding, is really trying to navigate this space in a way that protected their emotions, but also allowed them to kind of authentically be themselves.
And another strategy, that experimenting one, where people are like, hey, we're doing something different. We're going to start inventing our own traditions here. Could you talk a little more about what that might have looked like?
That strategy was so surprising to me, actually. Of all the strategies that people used, experimenting was really just going out there to see what feels right. So let me just try on all the different things, especially for instance, brides who didn't really want to wear a dress. They didn't want to wear a traditional dress. Maybe they thought they would wear pants or a jumper. And then they just went shopping and tried on all the different things that felt right. But the surprising thing for me about that was that I anticipated that it would move the industry forward, that we would see lots more, a broader range of gender expression and those sorts of things. But instead, what we saw, at least among our participants, was a lot more of sticking really close to the script. So I'll give you a story from one of our participants, Jocelyn. So she is kind of the bride I described, where she planned on wearing pants. And then her mother-in-law, on a whim, just said, oh, let's go dress shopping. This will be really fun. And she said, okay, I guess I'll do that. I'm not really interested in buying a dress, but why not? It's part of the tradition. And then she put a dress on, and she immediately said she was kind of overwhelmed by this feeling of feeling like a bride. She said, ooh, I feel pretty. And then instantly she judged herself for that and said, oh, that's not how I'm supposed to, this isn't my authentic sort of gender expression. I wanted to wear pants, but this just feels right. So something about the tradition of the script really tugged at her, as well as kind of prior socialization, which we haven't really talked about much, but and that resulted in this experimenting often just leading people back to the comfort of the script. So instead of seeing experimenting as something that opened up possibilities and opened the door, instead we saw it actually just reinforcing sort of traditions in the script and people really sticking closely to that for the comfort and tradition that it offered.
We're talking to Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing at the Wisconsin School of Business. talking about how same-sex couples plan wedding activities. When the wedding industry is rooted in a bride and groom world, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Are we talking about you and your wedding story? Did you run into some of these decisions and maybe some friction with the wedding industry that wasn't built for you as a same-sex couple? For any kind of couple, did you push back against the traditions in the wedding world? Did you stick with it, or did you end up following the script? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. We're talking about a study she co-authored looking at same-sex couples and how they dealt with a wedding industry that wasn't always quick to keep up with the legalization of same-sex marriage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is your story, the story of you planning a same-sex wedding here in Wisconsin or elsewhere, and maybe the wedding industry, whatever parts of it you dealt with, did serve your needs or didn't. Either way, I'd love to hear about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Amber, I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned, the power of the tradition of weddings, of our social script, of what we expect in this milestone and the power it has on us if we're getting married and on the wedding business, I guess.
Sure. So in our research, we spent a lot of time before we actually started talking to couples, looking at the history of weddings and reading through historical analyses of marriage and wedding markets, because we were really interested in the kind of where the script comes from and how we learn as consumers and as, you know, individuals getting married about what that script looks like. And so in our research, we did a lot of looking at, you know, popular press and media, the way that we're socialized into what to expect for a wedding through books and movies. I know when I was a kid, I watched Father of the Bride about a million times. And so this provides an image of what kind of a traditional wedding looks like. And then once we get engaged, the wedding industry kind of, there's this machine behind it that opens up that comes out with all of the wedding checklists and things you should do and what should a bride be and what should a groom be doing and those sorts of things. So for us, it was really interesting to think about the participants in the study and the expectations they had for weddings based on their own backgrounds, their own upbringings, their immersion in the cultural phenomena of weddings through media and books and those sorts of things, as well as exposure through their own family backgrounds and weddings they had attended growing up. And then the way that that informed their own understanding of the planning of the wedding. And the example that I gave of Jocelyn just a few minutes ago, trying on the wedding dress, one thing that she said after she was reflecting on it during our interview with her, and she said, you know, as a feminist, I'm not proud of that moment where I put the dress on and it just felt right, and then I bought the dress. And to me, I found that really fascinating, because that really shows this idea of the way that the emotional experience that has tied us to our prior socialization and background and the wedding script really comes into play whether you depart from the script. It feels really uncomfortable to do things that are different and that you're not sure are going to be accepted or recognized even by the audience, your family members and friends, but also to align with the script sometimes feels uncomfortable or discomforting because it's not an authentic representation of your own gender expression or your gender roles or the way that you anticipated the wedding. So I think prior socialization and that idea of the cultural phenomenon of the wedding was quite powerful throughout our analysis and our findings.
I wonder what you heard more from people, whether it was, I want to do it my way, but I'm worried that I'm doing it wrong given my own expectations, or I want to do this wedding my way, our way as a couple, but I worry that I'm letting down everybody else in the room, the family members and such who might be expecting that usual wedding script.
Both. I don't know that I heard one more than the other. I heard constant tension throughout the data and from participants in their stories, constant tension between wanting to do the wedding their way, and especially in related to honoring themselves as a couple and kind of debunking the gender roles that are embedded in the script, but also really wanting the wedding to be recognizable so that it was considered an, in quotes, a real wedding or a legitimate wedding, so that the audience could recognize all the parts of the wedding that make it a tradition and part of the heritage of wedding ceremonies. So I think that tension between both authenticity as well as tradition was kind of permeated throughout their experiences.
Talking to Amber Epp from the Wisconsin School of Business, looking at research on same-sex marriage and how couples in same-sex marriages going through the wedding experience run into an industry that wasn't necessarily built for them. Amber, we hear cases going to the Supreme Court where some element of the wedding industry, a service provider of some sort, says, yeah, I'm not going to provide services to same-sex couples, becomes a court case. That isn't necessarily what always happens, though. There are examples in your research of business providers collaborating with same-sex couples to solve these problems, or saying, yeah, I guess we need to change the way we do things. What kind of things did you hear?
Exactly. I mean, we did so intentionally because the study was, we were collecting data as the legalization pieces were unfolding across different states. We intentionally interviewed couples from all over the United States in both urban and rural areas, in places where it was legal and places where it was not. And then legalization came through at the federal level in 2015, right, as we were kind of closing out the study. And so we got to kind of see that viewpoint of places where it was more accepted and where service providers were quite collaborative and interested in opening up this space, as well as kind of the pushback that you're talking about. What I find really interesting is that at this time right now, as we're seeing, you know, new topics on this idea of gender inclusivity and the way that the different wedding industry partners are coming to the table, I think it's even more relevant now. This study is even more relevant now than it was when legalization was first happening, because we're seeing this broader conversation in society around gender and being brought kind of into the center of the culture wars. And so for me, trying to understand the way that this study might help us think about people's experiences with that in the wedding industry, in other places, I think is really a useful way to think about takeaways.
What kind of questions would you have if you were to kick off this study today, you know, years after same-sex marriage has been legalized? What would you want to track to see how things have changed?
I would really be interested in whether and how the script has been updated kind of within the industry. I think it would be useful to do a follow-up study that looked at the way that the wedding industry has or has not kind of questioned its own assumptions. I thought the caller, Nick, who said he just got married 4 years ago in Wisconsin and that the courthouse forms were still bride and groom, is telling, right? It suggests that there's more work in terms of just really understanding inclusivity. So there's, you know, no reason necessarily that the forms need to be gendered, especially given the legal status of marriage between same-sex couples. And so I think doing follow-ups where we're looking at the way that the industry has or has not revisited those assumptions about a binary built into the script, both kind of formally in the infrastructure and the forms and those sorts of things, but also informally in terms of, you know, who's targeted for checklists for wedding planning and who's included in the imagery and those sorts of things, I think would be useful to think about.
Amber, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. I had a great time.
That's Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. We talked to her today about a study she wrote for the Journal of Consumer Research looking at how same-sex couples are dealing with a wedding industry built around brides and grooms. Still time for you to share your story, or if you know someone who's encountered some of the pitfalls we've been talking about today, let us know about it. Love to hear, especially if you got something in the last year or two. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.